Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. Ever since a respected businessman and civilian pilot named Kenneth Arnold in June 1947 reported that he had seen nine strange shiny objects flying past Mount Rainier in Washington State and described them to the press later as looking like saucers, the media have reflected the general public interest in UFOs by reporting on these sightings, but always in an amused, tongue-in-cheek kind of way. The U.S. government has encouraged that giggling, skeptical treatment by explaining them away as weather balloons and airplanes and planets, flocks of birds, meteors, too much to drink, and almost anything except unexplainable flying vehicles. There have been blue ribbon studies of the subject, and even a long-running Air Force program in the 50s and 60s called Project Blue Book that purported to take it seriously, but still came to the same conclusion that nearly all of these sightings were misidentifications of mundane things by inexperienced observers. It actually buried those sightings that were clearly unexplainable. So this kind of dismissive treatment of detailed reports that often clearly were none of those things over the years inspired conspiracy theories of government cover-up and attracted a lot of people whose credibility and often downright looniness were less than helpful and fed into the government's apparent wish to avoid the subject. As a result, qualified observers, such as military and commercial pilots, have been reluctant to report sightings. You know, if you're passed over for promotion in a large organization, often you never know the real reason, right? But lately that's been changing, and actually changing fast. A big factor has been something that you've probably seen in the news. In 2004, and again in 2015, some Navy fighter pilots filmed with their gun cameras odd-looking objects out over the Pacific off San Diego and over the Atlantic off of Virginia Beach. These encounters were taking place over a long period and at times actually endangering them and their aircraft, but officially no one wanted to hear about it. But a Pentagon official took it on himself to release that footage to the media. And then in 2020, because by then the whole world was seeing these videos, the Defense Department had no choice but to declassify the videos and admit that they were real, and the dam began to break. Both in government and in academia, there's now a willingness to look into this topic with the seriousness that it deserves. My guest is one of those pilots who later has been speaking more prominently about this issue, and he's recently retired Navy F-A-18 fighter pilot Ryan Graves. Welcome, Ryan.
Hey, Court. Thanks so much for having me.
Appreciate you being on. So let's start at the beginning. Tell us what you and your fellow pilots saw back then. What did the objects look like, and what were their flight characteristics?
Yeah, so we started seeing these objects in 2014. We came back from deployment. At first, we didn't have a lot of information about what they looked like. We were just seeing them on our radar. And what we were seeing on our radar were objects that were either stationary or operating somewhere in the 0.6 to 0.8 Mach, which is around 240 to 350 knots. It's relatively fast, generally jet speeds, if you will. But these objects were hanging out all day in holding patterns or just flying straight and level or meandering against the wind, basically patterns that we didn't recognize as anything a normal aircraft would do. Eventually, we were able to see these even on our infrared cameras. And even later with our eyeballs, these ended up getting so close to our aircraft that we had to start filing hazard reports for near midairs.
So how often were you seeing them? And this is like an everyday occurrence or occasionally or what?
On our radar systems, which cover quite a bit of airspace, we were seeing objects that we suspected were these physical objects. We can't necessarily say 100% of the radar contacts correlated to a physical object, because very often when we would fly up to them, even though we would see them on our radar and we see them on our FLIR system, our IR camera system, and we'd fly within 1,000 feet of these objects, we just couldn't see them. There was nothing there. We'd turn back around and we'd see them on our sensors, and that was the best we could do. It wasn't until one of these objects was stationary at the entrance point to our working areas up at 12,000 feet, basically stationary at the front door, where two jets from my squadron flew past this object that almost hit them, and they finally got a good look at the object, and they were able to describe it as a dark gray or a black cube inside of a clear sphere.
Did they say roughly how big it was?
It's hard to estimate sizes when you're flying around when you don't have something to compare it to. But because they were flying in a section and it went between them, they were able to make a pretty rough estimate that it was somewhere in the vicinity of 5 to 15 feet in diameter.
So pretty small. But it must have been unnerving initially to have it showing up on all your sensors and you're looking right at where it should be, but there's nothing there. That must have been like, I could hit this thing and not even know it, you know? So
certainly when we were seeing it in different visual bands, if you will, with a IR sensor. So we were having visual representations of what they look like on our sensor systems, at least at the IR energy that was putting out. And you would expect from an aircraft traveling at over the speed of sound would have large exhaust plumes or would be putting out a lot of energy or heat energy, would have propellers or something, perhaps not supersonic, but some type of system we've recognized. But these objects were typically cold against the background, although they were often hot as well, but not emanating heat, just simply the heat was almost like black body radiation coming from the object, emitting from everywhere versus, you know, a spigot of hot air coming off the back of the object. So nothing that we would recognize.
And plus they had flight characteristics that would not be normally possible with the known propulsion systems and with the organic beings inside of them, I guess.
Yeah, we wouldn't expect to see that. You know, we've had some more information come from the All Domain Anomaly Resolution Office. That's the office within the Department of Defense that is currently tasked with taking a whole of government approach to this problem. And they've recently communicated about 50% of the objects that they are detecting are spherical objects of subtype that are traveling between 0 and 2 Mach. A sphere is a very non-aerodynamic shape. So these objects going at, you know, 2 Mach and not putting out high amounts of heat energy and things of that nature and the rapid movements, it's all just not things that we would expect a human to be able to operate or survive within with our normal engineering.
Yeah, we're not humans or any sort of, like I said, anything with flesh and bone or whatever would be instantly crushed by it. But so the objects that you guys were seeing, were they all about the same size and shape? I mean, the same kind of, I guess you described a more or less opaque cube encased in a more or less translucent or transparent sphere, right?
Yeah, dark gray or black cube inside a clear sphere. And essentially the tips of the cube were touching the inside of that sphere. So more or less a, you know, perfect fit. But at the time when this was, you know, happening in real time, and we weren't necessarily researching this, we were just trying to do our jobs, that was the primary report, a cube and a sphere. And that has persisted, and I've talked with military aviators, and I continue to, that still see that type of object. But as we look into some of the FOIA'd reports, and as I've started to research it more, other shapes and descriptions have come up as well, such as white cylindrical objects. There's a number of them. However, as we're seeing from Aero, about 50% of what's being reported is actually that sphere shape.
Yeah, and they were over a period of years. So, I mean, I have seen the description of a white tic-tac looking thing and like, you know, a little cylindrical, blunt-ended white object. But anyway, so, I mean, I guess it sounds like all or nearly all of the pilots in your squadron eventually saw these. Were there any skeptics among the other pilots who said, no, you guys are crazy, I don't know what you're seeing?
Well, we weren't really addressing this as something that to be called crazy because we hadn't jumped to any conclusions really at this point. I mean, for us, it wasn't our job to investigate this. This was an annoyance at best and a safety hazard at worst.
Right.
And so we, you know, we said, hey, okay, we see these on the radars. We thought they were radar errors. We saw them on our radar and our FLIR. We assumed they're real, but who knows? Then we start to realize they're pretty 5-15 feet is pretty substantial sized object compared to, you know, the birds that we're used to having to avoid. So from that perspective, you know, we didn't, again, immediately jump to, you know, anything exotic. It was, okay, this must be some type of classified program. So we never, you know, as a group got to this moment of combined clarity that this was anomalous, right? Like we never had that clarity.
You never sat down and had a whole conference among yourselves about the whole thing then.
So
you were the first, as I understand it, the first active duty military pilot to go to the U.S. Congress and report what you and other pilots were seeing. So were your fellow pilots behind you in taking a step that big? And, you know, were other people scared of what you were doing? Or how did that go, that whole interaction?
Yeah, you know, that was tough. And the way it went down was, you know, 2014, 2015, we were seeing these objects on a regular basis, but then we eventually left my whole squadron to go on deployment. Well, actually, we first did a workup cycle, which is us being gone for the better part of 6 months. And we were seeing these objects as we were operating off the coast of Jacksonville, Florida and elsewhere. And then we left. We left to go to the Middle East and to do our operations. And during that, my time in the squadron was up, and I left the squadron. I went to my next duty station, where I was an instructor pilot for the guys and gals going to fly the F-18 right after, just like I went through. And so I come back from deployment, doing everything else. This wasn't on my radar whatsoever. Just kind of assumed that it was taken care of, or it continued to be escalated until the problem was resolved in some fashion. But in 2017, a couple years after I had left, the New York Times article came out, and on the page was a picture of a video that I had seen when I was in the Navy. I was airborne. I knew the crew that took the video. I recognized their voices. I was in the secure space when they were debriefing it to the Admiral. And I was like, holy smokes, you know, this is still happening. This is still an issue. Well, I didn't know that quite yet, but I was shocked to see that, you know, it had escalated to this level. But then I started reaching out to some of the air crew that were still on the East Coast. And I was like, hey, you know, is that still happening? Is that still an issue? And they're like, oh yeah, you know, they're still out here. Nothing's, you know, being done. There's a NOTAM, which is a notice to airmen to say, hey, just watch out. They're briefing new air crew to be heads up for it. But that was as far as the problem had gotten. And that was really the moment when I realized it wasn't going to get resolved within the normal systems that we had. There just wasn't a process or a way to mitigate this risk to air crew. And that's when I reached out to the people that released the film and said, hey, I was there when that video was taken. You know, there's more than what was on the video, and I'm not going to tell you anything classified, of course, but I'm happy to talk more about it if you'd like. And that's kind of how I got involved. And through that process, I came to testify for the Senate Armed Services Committee and Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. And that was kind of my first foray into this. And to your original question of whether there was support, I specifically did an article in the New York Times. And during the process leading up to this testimony, I had some of the people that were vetting this story reach out to a number of other air crew that had experienced this, not just from my squadron, but from other squadrons. And they validated my story. And I had made it clear I could flip through my phone and, you know, my finger was probably going to land on a pilot that I could call and probably would report seeing these objects. It was just a matter of, you know, which one to call. So, you know, there were a handful that were called upon to not only validate a story through New York Times, but also some of them privately testified in a similar manner as I did in private, I'll say. And most of those people are still active duty. And so I would expect them to not speak publicly about it, at least at this time.
So what kind of reception did you get in Congress? I mean, those are not by and large military people or pilots, and you know, they got a lot of things on their plate. And to some extent, as I said in the beginning, this whole topic has always been viewed with some derision or skepticism anyway. So what kind of reception were you getting now that this, you know, seeing is believing, that these gun camera videos were out there?
Yeah, you know, I didn't come at this from any perspective about being able to explain this to them or be able to validate anyone's opinion of what these are. I simply reported to them what my systems that I was trained to use by them, more or less, and that we use to defend our country, we're also seeing other things that could potentially pose a threat to this country. It's not a matter of what they are or where they're from or what they represent. It's the fact that there's uncertainty in our battle space. And as military operators, I and other operators understand that uncertainty in a battle space is the killer. That's one of the main variables that we control for as fighter pilots, is knowing who's who in the zoo, as we say. And so leaving this uncertainty tactically is a non-starter. And that's what the conversation was about. The frequency that we were seeing these objects, their characteristics, you know, where we were seeing them, all these types of things have nothing to do with their potential conclusions and whatever social baggage may come from it. So to answer your question, it was a very pragmatic conversation about what our sensor systems were seeing. And it's hard to argue with that. And it's not a matter of belief or convincing them. I was simply reporting facts of what the data represented or what the data was.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with a recently retired Navy fighter pilot, Ryan Graves, who is kind of been leading the charge in making government more openly aware of the prevalence of unknown objects in their airspace that they fly in, and the kind of risks that those things present to them as pilots and therefore to the military in general. So as part of, I guess, the follow-on to that, Ryan is now the founder and CEO of a new organization called Americans for Safe Aerospace, or ASA. So what's the mission of the ASA, Ryan?
Well, it's pretty simple. The mission of ASA is simply to identify what's in our skies. We're unfortunately still in a position where we are still trying to resolve the inability to identify objects that are in our airspace. And we've seen that very recently with the recent takedown of a Chinese spy balloon. Whenever we have uncertainty in an operational area, that is a place where adversaries get in. And that's why it's so important to be able to identify and correlate and track objects as they operate in our airspace. And so Americans for Safe Aerospace, it's very simple for us. We want to identify what's in our skies. And if it is an adversarial platform, we need to treat it as a national security issue. If it's anything else, we need to have the scientific curiosity and frankly, courage to actually look at the problem and try to identify what it is. Because these things are going to exist in our airspace, whether we look at it or not. And air crew are going to continue to report seeing this, as they have to me, on a regular basis for the past several months. Air crew are seeing this both at high altitudes as well as co-altitudes, and they don't have a place to report this. And so Americans for Safe Aerospace is going to help support the pilots and other aerospace workers that have to contend with this issue without any formal support from any of the institutions.
Yeah, so ASA is not just Ryan. There are a lot of well-connected and important people going along on this mission with you. Why don't you kind of just describe a few of them quickly?
Yeah, absolutely. So the way we're looking at Americans for Safe Aerospace, we're really targeting this to be a mainstream organization that could look at this problem from the inside of the mainstream out. And so some of our advisors, we have Tim Gallaudet, the ex-head of NOAA. He's also a former rear admiral in the U.S. Navy. Susan McHugh, he's a former ex-chief staffer for Harry Reid. She's also the founding president and CEO of the One Campaign. John Letary, co-founder, president, and CEO of the Economic Innovation Group. Christopher Mellon, ex-deputy assistant secretary of defense for intelligence. David Radzinowski, ex-CFO and chief of staff at NASA, as well as ex-VP and CFO at the Aerospace Corporation. Terry Virts, former International Space Station commander and astronaut. And the list goes on. So, you know, we're really looking to get people that are at the head of their industry, their academic pursuits, and other areas that can come in and help not only advise how we can better educate the general public about this, but to be able to advise policy and legislation that's going to move this conversation forward, that's going to enable that transparency and open conversation about what's in our skies.
Yeah, so a roster of kind of heavy hitter people like that will increase the visibility of ASA, the Americans for Safe Aerospace, and also its likelihood of having an impact. So do you have a lot of pilots also contacting you already to kind of weigh in and ask if they can help or get involved?
Well, absolutely. So we've actually started an Air Crew Leadership Council at ASA, and some of the folks that included there are former Commander David Fravor of the Black Aces, ex-F-18 pilot who engaged with the Tic Tac, as well as Alex Dietrich, his partner in that endeavor. We have a number of other pilots, both commercial, ex-military, and we're going to be building out that leadership council because at the core, Americans for Safe Aerospace is a military pilot-led organization. And we really want to encourage pilots to be able to report this information. And it's not going to just go into some database. We want to be able to develop cases and be able to use the information we're learning to take that message to Congress, to Capitol Hill, and to show, use this data to show the stakeholders that we need to move legislation and move the conversation forward for very pragmatic reasons.
How about commercial airline pilots? Because I know that a lot of them, you know, over the years, you see reports that they see these kind of things and talk among themselves, even in real time in flight about it. And they have the same concerns you do that they're going to run into one of these things, you know?
My co-founders and I have been speaking to commercial pilots on nearly a daily basis for the past 6 to 8 weeks. That's how much this has been happening. We're receiving regular reports from activities over the Northern Pacific as well as the Northern Atlantic from not only U.S. carriers, but international carriers as well. We're seeing reports all the way from primarily 10,000 to about 35,000 feet of activity that's occurring co-altitude with these commercial air traffic. Typically what's happening, I mean, I'll say almost at the beginning of this conversation, really when I got involved, I'll say pilots didn't even want to report over the radio. They didn't want to, if one pilot came up and saw something and he reported it to the controller and the controller said, does anyone else see this? Pilots didn't even want to report that they were also seeing it because they didn't want their call sign associated with this. Mm-hmm. Now that's getting better. Now pilots are talking about this in the cockpit. Now they're sharing their stories amongst each other. And now they're contacting me and other organizations and reporting mechanisms to find if there's more information because they're curious. They want to know what they're seeing. The pilots are not the ones that are being dismissive and they would love to be able to follow up. And so we're trying to fill that need to some degree now by, you know, we're cataloging the information that's being received by these pilots that are, that feel comfortable and to report their cases to us. We're cataloging that and we're able to see some trends that are starting to form that are pretty consistent. So this is all more information that could be added to this conversation that we're choosing not to collect. And that's, you know, one of the policy positions at ACE is that we want to make sure we can enable proper, not only collection from pilots, but the follow-up analysis and the communication of that data as well.
Yeah. So for decades, it's been a taboo and like all taboos, you know, sensible, reasonable people don't really want to touch it. They just want to shy away from it. And no matter how they feel about it, they're scared of it. So, but you're helping break that taboo up. And as part of that shift in official attitudes, the Defense Department has renamed UFOs as Unidentified Aerial Phenomena, or UAP, which I guess is a way to put some distance between the new official interest and the old stigma of interest in UFOs by all kinds of people. So you mentioned earlier that the Pentagon recently established an all-domain anomaly resolution office. That's a mouthful like you always get in bureaucracies, right? But the AARO. But what does that office do? I mean, just briefly, we're getting kind of toward the end of the show. And do you anticipate that it'll be more forthcoming and transparent than the old Project Blue Book was that I mentioned at the outset?
Well, to the latter point, I think we'll have to wait and see. But generally speaking, AARO is tasked with taking a whole of government approach to this topic. The way they've communicated their objectives is that they're going to ingest this anomalous data. They have a process for attempting to resolve cases. If cases are resolved, they're channeled to the appropriate national security agency for potential prosecution if needed. And if it remains anomalous, we're not sure what happens with that data right now. But ultimately, that is the data that that AARO is interested in. They're not concerned about the national security threats once they've been identified. Their purpose is to continue to pursue and investigate the ones that remain anomalous. So whether AARO is going to be a vehicle for, you know, great public communication on this topic, I don't necessarily see that as a part of what Congress has demanded from. I don't see a lot of effort in that area unfolding from their office now. I can say that as someone who has, you know, worked to engage with their office under several capacities, both from an engineering angle and technical aspect through the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, as well as a public communication methodology as well. So I think, you know, more remains to be seen, but I think regardless of how the office is run at this time, I think the resources and authorities around that office are ultimately what's going to matter. And given the right authorities and people in that office, I think that it can do good things.
Yeah, so I guess as you said, it remains to be seen whether in the end it ends up being just another PR exercise to show the public that the military takes this seriously, but really doesn't. And hopefully it will be different in the new environment that you and others are helping to create.
I think it is different this time. And I think the dam has burst, frankly. I don't think we're back at a blue book time frame. I think there's too much momentum. I think organizations like ASA and others are going to be able to apply too much pressure to this. And it's a waterfall of information now. There's too many people that have seen this information just on the other side of the classification barrier. The information is new now. It's not necessarily buried in a SAP for 30 years. There's new reports, processes that have been put into place since 2018. New information is coming in, thousands of photos, imagery. And that's, you know, many thousands of people have the opportunity to look and analyze these videos and these images. And it's a matter of time till the public gets access to what these images are and gets to, you know, contemplate on what it means. I'm not saying anyone necessarily has already driven an arrow to the conclusion, but there's plenty of data that could certainly help that conversation with the general public.
You know, and there are other entities getting involved too that make it impossible to ignore. I mean, NASA is getting involved in this and had a workshop on it not long ago. And Harvard University has the Galileo Project, which has been tasked to look at just the data from outer space, really, from things that are anomalous and hard to explain, and just try to assess using different kinds of high-tech sensors what these objects are, you know. So there's various entities that are looking at it that, as you say, the dam is broken, right? So a lot of players are getting involved. Well, let's see, we are toward the end of the show, Ryan. I would say that the things you saw weren't the classic flying saucer, obviously, from what you described. So I'll ask you to speculate about something you probably don't want to speculate about, but what's your best guess as to what these objects are? I mean, is it even possible from what you could see that they're possibly man-made? Is that even possible from what you've seen?
It's tough to say. I don't think there's going to be one answer to quote unquote what these things are. Certainly, you know, adversary platforms, things are going to fall out. But even now, if we look at what I was claiming we were seeing, these spheres that are operating at, you know, supersonic and subsonic speeds, that's now what's being confirmed by the All Domain Anomaly Resolution Office. These spheres are being seen operating from 0 to 2 Mach. We don't know. And that's what Aero has been stood up. So I think it's an exciting time, because very rarely do we get to attack a true mystery like this. And so I encourage people to pay attention and to not jump to conclusions. We don't have to have an answer for this right away. I think that's a bit of a fallacy that we find ourselves falling towards. So it's okay to exist in that uncertainty zone. That's where I've been for the past 5 years or 8 years now. So come join me. The water's fine.
Okay. Well, getting back to the ASA, Americans for Safe Aerospace, I think you've kind of said it really, but again, what's the main, if you had to put it in a bumper sticker, what's the main thing you hope to accomplish with it?
We want to be able to identify what's in our skies 100% and have an honest, open conversation about what that means.
Yeah, that was a pretty good bumper sticker. Well, gosh, it's been really interesting talking with you, Ryan, and congratulations on you being willing to go out front as you are and kind of take the bull by the horns on this thing that's been, you know, many, many pilots throughout decades have experienced this, but there's a barrier or a blockade to even dealing with it in any kind of official way, in the way that you'd normally deal with anything that threatens air safety like that. So breaking that barrier is just important for an obvious reason. So to see articles and videos and more about this, you can go to ASA's website at safeaerospace.org. One word spelled like it sounds, safeaerospace.org. Ryan, I want to thank you for being on with us in American Variety.
It was my pleasure, Court. I had fun.
Yeah, interesting. And thanks to all of you out there for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.